This is a short lecture on In Mrs. Tilsha's Class by Caroline Duffy, a new poem for the Scottish set text for the SQA examinations for National 5 and higher. I'm not working from a script for this, so I'm just going to talk you through how I've annotated my copy of the poem. The poem's split into four stanzas, each of 8 lines. It's unrhymed. There is a distinct change in tone at the end of the second stanza. If this were a sonnet, we would talk about the volta, the turning point. We don't need that vocabulary as such, but we do need to be aware that there is a definite turning point at the end of the second stanza. So, you could travel up the Blue Nile with your finger, tracing the route while Mrs. Tilsha chanted the scenery. Tanna, Ethiopia, Khartoum, Aswan. There's a lot going on here. The first verb, travel, suggests that when you're in Mrs. Tilsha's class, in that primary school class, she took you places. In your imagination, you escaped from the mundane, from the ordinary. And not just to any old places, to exotic places. And the example that she gives is the Blue Nile, which she traced with her finger. So we can imagine the child with a picture of the Nile River moving from its source up towards its mouth, moving the finger as the river moves. This is reinforced by the list, Tanna, Ethiopia, Khartoum, Aswan. And these are all locations along the route, along the river Nile as it flows to the mouth. Mrs. Tilsha chants the scenery. So in the past, there was a lot more rote learning where people just repeated and they chanted the words until they remembered them. This was a cornerstone of British education for hundreds of years. But that chanting, I think, in this sense, has a musical connotation. Yes, the pupils were chanting and memorizing these places as they went, but there's no sense of resentment. There's no sense of it being unhappy. I think it's a more musical kind of a chant the child associates with Mrs. Tilsha. We change then. And Duffy says that for an hour, as if that was a self-contained thing, and then they stopped doing that, and then they did something else. And that's a very childlike approach to the way the day is structured. That for an hour, then a skittle of milk. It's an interesting choice of description here. Choice of noun. A skittle. A skittle can be a bottle, or it can be a pin in a game of skittles, a game of bowls. So there's a playfulness in that particular word. But the skittle of milk is a reference to, up until the late 1970s, children in British schools were given free milk in primary school to help them grow, to help them be healthy. But that was withdrawn at the end of the 1970s. And there was a split in the day where children would sit down and they would have a small bottle of milk. And that's what that is referring to. She then continues and talks about the chalky pyramids, and this is a pun. On the one hand, the pyramids are chalky because in reality the pyramids are made out of sandstone, which is a chalky kind of stone on the fingertips. But also these pyramids are being drawn on a blackboard, so they're chalky from the chalk that's drawn them there. And then we have this lovely dual meaning, rubbed into dust. And there is a sense. The first sense is that as soon as the children are finished learning about the pyramids, they're rubbed from the board. But also there's a sense that the pyramids themselves, over time, will be eroded and they will disappear. They will fade from human memory. So that's a nice little dual meaning, rubbed into dust. A window opened with a long pole. In many schools in Britain, there were windows which were very high up in the walls, and the only way to open them was to have a long pole with a hook on the end. And I certainly remember from my time in primary school, it was kind of a privileged position to be given the long hook to open the windows. At the end of the first stanza, she talks about the laugh of a bell. And this is a beautiful description. It kind of evokes the happiness of primary school, because the bell isn't a signal of alarm. It's not a signal of danger. It's a signal of something that's kind of jolly. Yes, they're going to the next class, but the bell does not alarm them. And the bell is being swung by a running child. And again, in primary schools, it was certainly not uncommon for the bell between periods or between breaks or whatever it was to be swung by a child. Again, it was a kind of a privileged chore to be given. Second stanza. This was better than home. And it's such a pure, simple statement. And it encapsulates the joy that Duffy felt of being in this classroom. Better than home. Look at the descriptors. The books are enthralling. That's really exciting. And the classroom glowed. This is not the drab environment of outside school. This is an exciting place, a colourful place. And it, not only does it glow, we have the simile, it glowed like a sweet shop. And within that simile, we have all those ideas of a sweet shop being full of things that are attractive, that catch our eye, that we want, that taste good. The first thing that she mentions after the sweet shop, and again, it's kind of a play on words, almost a pun. The first thing she mentions is sugar paper. Now, sugar paper is not sweet. It's not something you eat. It's a kind of coarse paper that's used for crafts. But it's interesting that she places that craft paper immediately after she mentions the sweet shop. Sugar and sweet. So we've got the craft paper and then the coloured shapes. These are things which are common to any primary school experience. Cutting things out, making shapes, sticking things down. All primary school activities, all enjoyable. But then Duffy sounds the first note of negativity. She mentions Brady and Hindley. Myra Hindley and Ian Brady were murderers of children. They were known as the Moors murderers, and they killed a number of children in Yorkshire in the early 1960s. By using that, we can pin down this period that Duffy was at primary school to the early 1960s, because these figures were talked about and discussed and in all of the media in the early 1960s. And nowadays, Brady and Hindley, it's like it's a byword for child murder. But after that initial note of negativity, she says Brady and Hindley faded. It's the power of Mrs. Tilsher that these monstrous people who murder children, even those people, fade away in this classroom. So while it's a note of negativity and we have that pause at the end of the line, the enjambment, Brady and Hindley faded. They couldn't touch the children in Mrs. Tilsher's class. And then she goes on to describe these murderous people like a faint, uneasy smudge of a mistake. It's a metaphor suggesting that the horror could just be wiped away. Brady and Hindley happened, but it was a mistake, so we'll just wipe it away. In Mrs. Tilsher's class, these people couldn't reach you. And that's reinforced by the very next line. Again, very simple, like this was better than home. Mrs. Tilsher loved you. Some mornings you found she'd left a gold star by your name. You can feel the sense of pride. And I don't think there's a single person who would read this poem and get to that point and not remember the pride you felt when you were in primary school, when a teacher gave you a prize, a reward, a kind word, a gold star by your name. And The fact that Duffy is writing a poem about her primary school teacher reinforces how significant a person she was. The scent of a pencil. This is evocative. Everybody can imagine the fragrance of a freshly sharpened pencil. And for most people, it will take you back to your school days. And for some people, it will take them specifically to their primary school days. And what I really need to emphasize here are a couple of adjectives which we'll call back to later on. Slowly, carefully shaved. There is no rush here. The pencil is sharpened, but everyone's taking their time. There is no rush. That's going to form a contrast later. And finally, the last line, which is really, it's a lovely transferred epithet. A xylophone's nonsense heard from another form. I think most people, again, can remember the sound when you're in the corridors of a primary school and you hear in some distant classroom somebody playing with a xylophone. Not well, not skilled, just perhaps dragging the beater up and down across the bars. And that's the nonsense she's talking about. It's jangling, it's carefree, it's unstructured, it's nonsensical, but it's happy. And then we have the turning point. Over the Easter term, that period in spring, Easter, the inky tadpoles changed. Now, the inky tadpoles are likely to refer to the tadpoles which were often collected by primary school children as part of their classwork. They would go out and they would go for a walk and they would find tadpoles, they would find frog spawn, and then perhaps bring it into the classroom to look at it. So we need to imagine these inky tadpoles that they'd collected and brought back into the classroom. But the inky tadpoles are also the children themselves. Tadpoles clearly are underdeveloped young frogs to be. And equally, the children are adults to be. So in this progression from tadpole to frog, you should also be considering the metaphorical meaning from child to young adult, or to teenager, I should say. The inky tadpoles changed from commas into exclamation marks. Duffy is using punctuation marks again to describe this progression. So we can imagine the small tail on a comma to the much longer tail on an exclamation mark. But the exclamation mark also carries that sense of danger or fear. It's by its nature, exclamation, it is literally a shouting out. So there's been an alarming change to the tadpoles, but also to the children, the exclamation marks. And then we find it taken to its logical conclusion. Three frogs hopped in the playground. All of a sudden, there is maturity. Sexual maturity, perhaps, but certainly this growth is kind of summed up in the metaphor of the three frogs. And I detect, you might not, but I detect a sense of bitterness when Duffy says that these frogs were freed by a dunce. Who would do such a thing? Who would let this maturity out when life in Mrs. Tilsher's class was so perfect, when it was so innocent and so cheerful? Why on earth would you let the frogs out? Why would you let the children mature? I think there's a sense of anger, and at the very least, a sense of disappointment. It was unwise to let the children mature, to let the frogs hop into the playground. But it's often the case, sexual maturity is hypnotic to children, and the frogs are followed by a line of kids. They're curious. They're curious about these frogs. And again, it has a metaphorical meaning. They're curious about this underlying sexual growth, this emerging teenage personality, the hormonal flux inside the children. And now they're jumping and croaking. The croaking is, I think, a very clear expression of the dropping of a voice from a more high-pitched to a lower-pitched one. It now croaks. And it leads the children away from the lunch queue. They're being taken astray. The frogs are taking the children astray. A rough boy told you how you were born. Again, a very direct, simple statement. It's interesting that it's a rough boy, somebody who did not consider the consequences. And the first response to this is anger. You kicked him, but stared at your parents appalled when you got home. You might have been angry with the rough boy, but more than that, you were disappointed in your parents that this, to a young mind, this appalling act of sex, you couldn't believe that your parents did it. You didn't want the adult world. If you want to be poetical about it, you could suggest that this is like the Garden of Eden, the fall. The children are Adam and Eve, and then when they have knowledge, like Adam and Eve, they're cast out. They have to become teenagers because they can't unlearn the sexual knowledge which they have just found. The last paragraph really hones in on the hormonal sexual development. That feverish July. Feverish is an important adjective suggesting heat, frenzy, loss of control, the hormonal change that is occurring. The air tasted of electricity. Very often before a thunderstorm, you can sort of taste the electric in the air. So that line indicates there is a storm coming. Is it a sexual storm? Is it a adulthood? Is it simply a rainstorm? It's all of these things mixed together. The air tasted of electricity, a tangible alarm, made you always untidy, hot, fractious under the heavy, sexy sky. The heat of the storm, again reflecting this hormonal change. You asked her how you were born, almost like you're trying to double check that the rough boy, maybe he was wrong. Maybe we can go back to being primary school children who didn't know about these things. And Mrs. Tilsher smiled. She reassures them with the smile, but again, it's a nice use of enjambment, like previously. There's that pause. Mrs. Tilsher smiled, then turned away. She was not willing to tell the children the truth about reproduction. She was unwilling to break their innocence. She wanted to preserve that as long as they could. Reports were handed out. You ran through the gates, ran through the gates. Now, this is a place where previously the children had loved to be, and now they were rushing. Remember that slowly, carefully shaved pencil. Now it's about rushing through the gates, desperate to get away, desperate to find out more of this sexual discovery. You ran through the gates, impatient to be grown, wanting to be an adult, wanting to take part in that world that initially is so frightening. And finally, the last line, as the sky split open into a thunderstorm. And that thunderstorm sums up the sexual maturity, the confusion of sexuality, the difficulties of adult life, and the loss of that simple innocence of the first two stanzas.